Allison Thompson was celebrating Christmas with her boyfriend Oscar in New York City in 2004 when she first learned about the massive earthquake and tsunami that had devastated much of the Southeast Asia. Although she wasn't connected with any established aid group, she decided she had to go there to help. Within days, she and Oscar had scrounged up $300 in cash, collected a bag of medical supplies, convinced friends to obtain plane tickets for them, and had taken off for Sri Lanka. She describes the 14 months that they spent there, nursing the injured and caring for refugees in a memoir she's called The Third Wave. She wrote it with, is it Mae Mae Fox?
Yeah, Mae Mae Fox.
And it's published by Spiegel & Grau, and I'm very pleased it has brought Allison Thompson to our show today. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
This book has such a gonzo sensibility. I was wondering if you were related to Hunter Thompson.
No.
In her review of it in the Wall Street Journal last week, Megan Klein suggested that your book reminded her of the script for an action movie. Have you been approached by anyone interested in bringing it to Hollywood?
Yeah, I actually have, and we made a doc. We didn't go to make a doc. We just sort of happened after coming back with lots of footage. And
a documentary of the same name, The Third
One. Yeah, the documentary of the same name. And, I just haven't explored it or anything because I'm busy working. But I just can't imagine that Hollywood could make it so real as what the real thing is, because it's very extreme.
Your documentary was shown at the Tribeca Film Festival and at Cannes in 2007?
Yes.
Where does the name come from, The Third Wave?
In our village, there were two waves. The first wave completely destroyed the village. It was about a 10-foot wave. And then the second wave was about a 40, 50-foot wave that killed on all in the whole area, 250,000 people. So the third wave is all the volunteers that flood into the country to help. So that's what the third wave means.
And how different, or is it very similar to what happened in Japan?
It's very similar, but it's also very different. It's a lot.
Well, there's no nuclear facility here.
Yeah, but things are a little different when it hits a third world. Japan is quite a first world, and they have a good structure, and they have a tsunami warning system in place. So they have a lot more help in place. So it's different, but it's the same. People were killed, and it's just as dangerous.
You'd already been working as a filmmaker when the tsunami struck. Were your friends skeptical when you told them that you were rushing to the disaster site to help the victims? Did they assume that your real intention was to make a movie?
No, not at all, because I've really been doing this my whole life. With my parents were missionaries growing up, and I would go with them all over Asia helping out. But September 11th, it was my real volunteer mission, and that's when I went down there on rollerblades. And I'd really learned how to volunteer there for 9 months. So for me, it was just a volunteer mission. I had my little tiny camera in my hand, handheld camera. I thought, I'll take a few images over the 2 weeks, and I'll come back, cut 5 minutes, and have a fundraiser. But it turned into something a lot more.
And 9/11, you were living in New York at the time?
Yeah, I was living on the Upper East Side when the planes hit the tower.
And that was bad partly because of all the dust and the asbestos released into the air. Were you concerned at the time?
Not at all. You mean when I was working down there?
Yeah.
No, I didn't even think about things like that. It was just getting through each moment. For example, rollerblading down there and just getting through each hour and each day. And then the first 6 days I lived in the streets collecting the bodies. And you don't think about things like that. You're just thinking about my friends that were killed. I had 23 of my friends killed that day. And just trying to find people. That was all in the mind.
So when you decided to go to Sri Lanka, how long did you expect your trip to last?
We had a plane ticket for 2 weeks. It was in the Christmas holidays. And we found this village, and we say, I'll stay here for a couple of days. But then we're like, a couple more. And it turned into 14 months on all.
You encourage your readers to strike out on their own as volunteers and even include a list of tips at the back of your book for how best to go about it. Why did you and Oscar decide to do it solo rather than look for an established organization to work with?
Well, I learned on September 11th that these disasters are getting so big, and they are too big for the governments and just the NGOs, and there is a place for the volunteer. I don't have a lot of really big skills, but I have a lot of little ones that add up, and everyone's needed to get involved. When a disaster happens, it's not just medical. You've got thousands of orphans, and it's mums and dads and actors and singers and radio hosts. Everyone can do something. So I could do it. So I thought, I could do it again. And you get there, and the people are helping, great NGOs helping every way, but then there's like 100 miles with no one helping. So you can always slip into a little spot and help.
And as I mentioned, you went to Sri Lanka. Why Sri Lanka? Wasn't Indonesia where most of the media attention was centered at the time?
Yeah, growing up in Australia, I knew that the Australians were right there and they had a lot of people heading there. But I had friends that used to surf in Sri Lanka and I knew how bad it was. And even when you get sick there, you have to not go to their hospitals, you have to fly back to Australia. So I just knew that they wouldn't have much help. So that's why I wanted to go to that area.
And how many days after the tsunami hit did you arrive?
We arrived about 10 days after the tsunami and we were just looking around and saying, where is everyone? Where's the help?
Soon after your plane landed, you and Oscar teamed up with two other unaffiliated volunteers, and the four of you ended up working together for almost a year. One of them, Bruce, was a friend of a friend who'd flown in from Colorado, where he'd been, is it true, a private chef of Pearl Jam?
Yeah, and he's actually with Paul McCartney right now, doing private chef.
Do rock and rollers eat special kinds of foods?
Yeah, I think they've partied a little too much, and now they're ready to go organic.
And then you met the other one, an Australian engineer named Donnie, by chance at the baggage claim at the airport. Did he say, I'm just going to help?
Yeah, he says, I'm on a mission from God and I'm going to help. And I thought he was maybe a religious type, but that was all the religion we ever got out of him. But he was amazing. He was an ex-engineer and he could, you know, build toilets. And it was actually selfish when I asked him because I thought, oh, he could probably put up the tents and do a lot of the work and that. So
and he was also an Australian, which probably led to some kind of connection.
Yeah, he was Australian. But then I had to go over to my jealous Sicilian boyfriend at the time and say, oh, I invite this guy to come with us. And it all worked out okay.
Most people would have been afraid to have gone down to the World Trade Center after 9/11 and then go into this area. Are you somebody who's just not bothered by fear?
No, I've been crippled by fear my whole life, you know. This incident, I was rollerblading down, and I had a really brilliant, great life, a long life, and I said a little prayer. I said, you know what, I'm going to accept my death, and if it's my time, it's my time. And after I said that little prayer, I didn't feel scared anymore. Nothing happened to me or anything, but that's when you take that fear away, you can fly.
Do you think to some degree it's because your father was a preacher?
No, I don't think it was anything to do with that. It was just something deep inside of me that was just deep.
My guest is Allison Thompson, who's written The Third Wave, a volunteer story with the help of Mamie Fox. So the four of you got all of your belongings. You rented a minivan and drove toward the coast. You didn't have a specific destination in mind, did you?
No, we just thought we'd start driving along, and then we found this village with the upturned train, and there were 3,000 people dead, and we thought, well, let's just stop here.
Wasn't there also a civil war going on in Sri Lanka at the time?
Yeah, in the north, in Jaffna, there'd been a civil war.
But that also was an area that was hit, wasn't it?
Oh, it was desperately hit, and the aid got up there at the beginning, but then they stopped the aid because they didn't want it to go to the Tamil terrorists.
And actually, the whole civil war was resolved after the tsunami. I don't know whether the tsunami played a role in ending that war. I know the government forces surrounded the Tamil Tigers and killed off some of the leaders, and that pretty much ended it. Have you heard anything about what's going on now?
We're in close contact with the area. We actually had a soccer match up there against the Tamil Tigers during the war, and we just wanted to have one day of peace. We had no agenda but to play soccer, and we went off and met the terrorists, and they blindfolded us and took us out, and we finally arranged it all, but then the day was a little nerve-wracking, but we pulled the day off, and it was very successful.
You had stopped in a few towns before you settled in the village that you stayed in. What is it? Paralia?
Paralia.
Why there?
We did meet the two people along the way, and they go, "Hey, look, we found this village. They need really help. Come there." And that was just where we landed, but it ended up being the ground zero of the area. And that was we just started a little field hospital and started with a few people wandering around, and then we got up to about 1,000 patients a day, every day, and then doctors and nurses around the world were just drawn to it, and they came. So it just by coincidence, we just landed there.
Well, Bruce and Donnie obviously had brought some real skills, cooking and engineering. What about Oscar, your boyfriend?
Yeah, that was interesting.
He was a film producer, wasn't he?
Yeah, and the first few days he didn't know what to do. But he's a magician. He just loves to do magic. So he just started doing magic with the kids, and they just started laughing. And that's what he did. And he smoked a lot. He chain-smoked, you know, a lot more than usual because he was a bit nervous. But in the end, he realized, hang on, I can use the same skills what I do back home. I can produce a village. So then he started putting kids with buckets out the front to catch the tourists and raise money and all these things. And I just stood back and I was like, yeah, it's the same skills.
And you'd had training as a nurse and a teacher?
Yeah, basic nurse's aide, and I used to be a math teacher.
But that's a far cry from starting up a medical clinic.
Yeah.
How many people did you treat?
We treated over 90,000.
90,000 people?
People in that first 8 months. You know, I know how to direct. I know how to direct people, and it was like being a school teacher. You know, everyone's in shock. They're lying around. They've got 20 families dead, and it's really bad. You go over there. Okay, we need some food. Let's stop a truck on the highway. And it's really just directing people where to go, and that's what it was for the hospital. I grabbed a doctor I found and another nurse, and I was really guiding them. And then collecting medical aid and building a hospital.
And you've said that no one ever questioned your authority.
No.
As long as you sound like you know what you're doing,
yeah,
people will trust you.
Even going back into Ground Zero, I had to get out to get some things. And I was a little nervous I was going to be locked out when they had all the SWAT surrounding, but I just had confident look and just walked back in like I belong there.
Is that because when people have been hit by something like this, they're so stunned, they need somebody to just push them in the right direction?
Yeah, they're just in such shock, and they just don't know what to do, and they just need someone to go, hey, you know, go over there and do that. And also they said, even if we didn't have anything to give them, the fact that we came from such a big, important country, to come to them and listen to their story, that was enough.
So you mentioned you found some other people, recent medical grads from Germany who helped you at the hospital. What kinds of injuries were you treating most?
A lot of infections, pneumonia, broken hands and legs, so many different things. Babies with 104 temperature.
And then in time you got help from a German disaster relief team that arrived to set up water tanks. The Danish government donated materials for 700 temporary shelters which your group assembled.
Yeah.
But you were most impressed, you say, by an Israeli volunteer group that arrived and played games with the children that were designed to release trauma.
Yeah, the Israelis really know how to do their aid work. And they come in and play games. And it was the first day we saw the kids laugh and run around. And we were crying our heads off. And later that night, they brought out nice red wines. And they know that we need a little help, too, sometimes at night to just have a little release as well.
How aware were people on the outside of all of this? There was a website?
Yeah, a journalist came through and said, you need to create a website to get more volunteers to come. And I just wrote at the top, okay, come, here's the address, we need you all, you're all welcome. And then they started turning up in the droves.
Even though many of them had no skills?
Yeah, they'd even drive by and like, we were rejected from the Red Cross and all these big organizations because we don't have a master's degree. I'm like, come in, you're very welcome. And they're like, we don't have skills. I'm like, and an hour later I'd see them out there doing amazing stuff.
You made it a priority to collect the bodies of the people who died, and many times it sounds like it was rather difficult and gruesome. In fact, your descriptions are pretty disturbing. Why was collecting corpses so important?
It was important to find everybody's relatives. I know I would want my mother or father to be found, just to have someone to bury. But also the dogs were starting to eat in all the bodies, and some people had buried them maybe a little half a foot under the ground. So we had to dig them up and give them a proper burial. You know, a dog would run by with a femur bone in their mouth and things like that. You know, people said to me, how can you do that? How can you pick up a body? I could never do it. You can. You think about it and you talk about no, but when you're in the spot at the time, you've got your gloves on, you've got the bag, it's there in front of you, you go, oh, well, okay, 1, 2, 3, boom, and it's in the bag, and then you can do it.
People who've worked in disaster areas have told me that it's difficult to return home and then resume ordinary lives. Was that a problem for you?
You know what? So many people wrote me emails saying it was difficult to fit back into their lives, and I said, that's a good thing, because now there's going to be more change for the world. You don't want to slip back into that mediocre life you had before.
Well, some people have very rich lives.
Oh,
but,
yeah.
But in your case, you found a calling, and you wound up going to Haiti after the earthquake?
Yeah. ended up racing over to Haiti with a bunch of doctors I found on Facebook. And we thought we're going for 2 weeks again. I think I could have learned my lesson a little bit, but no. And then we ended up finding a camp, and 65,000 people had moved onto a golf course, and they were all looking to us for food and water. So it started all again on a bigger scale.
Well, Haiti seems to be taking – it seems to be rather difficult for Haiti to recover. What's the situation like now?
I felt hope in Haiti only for the first time in the last 2 months, and rubble is being picked up, and lots of programs are being done by lots of small grassroots. And Global Dirt Example, the one that works with us, they're doing lots of things. So I'm really seeing movement, and there's a new president, and he has this more capitalistic economy mind of thinking. So we feel that there's real hope there right now.
Although Sri Lanka remains a troubled country, have things pretty much stabilized at least?
It's stabilized right now, but we hear the Tamil Tigers are reforming in the underground. But at least most of the homes are built and back to a general way that they were before the tsunami.
And the government in Colombo remains a bit repressive, and that's another problem. Yeah. But that has nothing to do with saving people's lives after a tsunami.
Yeah.
And that's the topic of Allison Thompson's book, written with the help of Maymay Fox. It's called The Third Wave, and it's published by Spiegel & Grau. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
On tomorrow's show, Pamela Constable, who's been reporting on South Asia for years, explains why Pakistan continues to struggle with its identity 60 years after it was founded. And then the French actress Marie Riviere discusses working with the great director Eric Rohmer on classics like The Rayon Vert. Also, Esmeralda Santiago on her new novel, Conquistadora, which follows a young woman from 19th century Spain to Puerto Rico. And our word maven, Patricia T. O'Connor, will be taking your calls on the complexities of the English language. The Let It Lope show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Jessica Miller, Kevin Sun, Avery J.C. Kleinman, and contributing producers Fran Jacobs and Virginia Doris. Debbie Founder was at the audio controls. I'm Let It Lope, your host. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you tomorrow.